Radio.
Hello and welcome to Kind Voice Radio. I'm your host, David Levin, and on Kind Voice Radio, we tell the stories about people who are making our world, the one we will all share, a kinder, more connected place. And one way people do that is through a concept called servant leadership. And our guest today, Jim Hunter, is a best-selling author on two books on servant leadership, and he has a list of clients, an amazing list of clients that feature a lot of the best places to work for on the Fortune 100 list. So it's a beautiful story, and I'm thrilled to have Jim on. Jim, welcome to the show.
Thank you, David, for having me. Thrilled to be here.
Now, it's a good deal what you are doing with servant leadership. Can you give the folks an overview of what servant leadership is?
Okay. Well, yeah, there's a lot of misunderstanding. Servant leadership's exploding all over the world, and it's exploding in our country. It's been around for a couple thousand years, but boy, over the last 40 or so, it's really gaining hold. And it's also a misunderstood term. So let me give you my take on it. Breaking it up into two words, servant leadership. Let's take the leadership part first. Leadership. There's another misunderstood word. For me, leadership is it's a skill. It's the skill of being able to inspire and influence people. To excellence, to that gets people to own the mission, your character, that your personal character that inspires confidence and excellence. In short, leadership is the skill of getting people to enthusiastically work toward goals identified as being for the common good. So it's the skill to influence and inspire. Now, what gives us the right to do that? How do we inspire? How do we influence people? And that's where the servant part comes in. We have to earn the right to be the leader. We have to people give us this authority with them, and we develop that authority through serving. And by being a servant, we're not talking about being a slave. We're not talking about doing what people want. What my children want is much different than what my children need. What my employees want is generally a little bit different than what they need. I'm not here to be your slave, but I am here to be your servant. I am here to identify and meet your legitimate needs, and that's what the role of the leader is, to meet their needs. And, you know, people say, well, okay, what needs do my people have? And I say, well, let's look at the golden rule. You know, what needs do you have? You know, I tell people in the business world, just be the boss you wish your boss would be. We're done with the seminar. Let's go golfing. I mean, you know, that person you want your boss to be is the same person your people want you to be. You know, be the father you wish your father had been more fully for you. Be the mother you wish your mother had been more fully for you. The neighbor you wish your neighbor would be. The coworker you wish your coworker would be. So really, it's really about doing the right thing for people and meeting their needs. So when we serve and when we sacrifice and we build relationships with people, we build influence with them. It's just the law of the harvest. You know, you reap what you sow, David. You serve, you sacrifice, you give people what they need, you appreciate them, you listen to them, you hug them when they need a hug, you spank them when they need a spank, you help them to be better than the best they can be. They naturally become indebted, and I mean they want to return. They want to give back. They're inspired by people that do that for them. And so that's what the servant leadership is. It's identifying and meeting the legitimate needs of your people, serving and sacrificing for them, which inspires and influences them to own the mission. That's the best I can do with what servant leadership is, the way I understand it.
And it creates a beautiful picture to me of planting seeds and nurturing them and having them grow towards the sun of serving each other. So it's a beautiful thing you're doing. What about this concept really resonates with you on a personal level? Because you started doing this back in 1985. Is that correct?
Well, I actually started the business in 1985. I was actually involved with it about 6 years prior to that. 1979 is when I really started. I had an employee relations firm, and actually I was working in very troubled companies. I was a labor relations person in a consulting firm, and I would go into very troubled organizations. Here in Southeast Michigan, I'm from the Detroit area. arguably the toughest labor area in the world. And I would go into these environments, typically manufacturing environments, where there would be just dysfunction. There would be strikes and then sabotage and turnover and absenteeism and low commitment and low morale. I mean, the people are acting out bad. And our job was to come in and play company doctor and figure out what was going on and, diagnose and prescribe, fix this thing for us. And invariably what I found, David, 10 years of doing that, was the issue was always leadership. The problem wasn't Chucky on the forklift handing out union cards. The problem was in the front office, typically the person who hired me. They were, whenever you see a dysfunctional organization, you want to check leadership first, because 9 times out of 10, that's where the issue is. And conversely, great organizations, you show me a great marriage, you show me a great family, a great business, a great ball team, a great organization, two or more people get together for a purpose, I'll show you a leadership issue that got them there. I mean, everything rises and falls on leadership. And so what I decided at that point was out of dealing with the symptoms of the problem and start dealing with the real problem. The real problem was leadership. And I was out dealing with the symptoms of the problem, the acting out, and not dealing with the real issue. Interestingly, my wife, who is a psychologist, has the same phenomenon in her business, where parents will bring these acting out children to her and say, you got to fix these kids. And initially in her practice, that's what she would try to do is, well, okay, you parents go off to dinner and we'll get to work on the kids. Well, she doesn't practice that way anymore. Now what we do is we send the kids to the playroom and we spend some time focusing on the leadership team. And if we start fixing some of that, what's going on with mom and dad, a lot of times the symptoms start to subside. So all too often, I think in organizations, we're dealing with the symptoms and not dealing with the problem.
It's a good skill to be able to understand the sequence of things to fix them at the core. Now, when a leader brings you in, do you give them a heads up in advance that you might have some suggestions for them and gauge how comfortable they are before you take on a client?
Well, now I do. Of course, my first 10 years, the first 30, when I was out there, they were having me in for a specific problem. You need to fix this, right? Our problem's Chucky on the forklift, this guy handing out the union cards. We got to shut him up. If we fix Chucky, then we'll be happy, But I knew deep in my heart that I was going to do a dog and pony show for 6 or 8 weeks to earn the right to tell the person at the top, and it was typically a man, I was going to earn the right to tell him, you're the problem, man. You got me out here dealing with the symptoms. But obviously he wouldn't have hired me if I come in on the first day. But now, now my business has changed. I mean, now that I teach servant leadership and help organizations to not only understand it, but to help people get it into their game. Of course, now people come with a much more open, looking to grow and looking to be, looking to change. I mean, they're teachable. So I don't have to earn the right quite so much anymore as I did in the past, if that makes sense.
It's a nice thing to get to that whole different level. Now, how do the principles of servant leadership differ if you're applying them, say, in a fast food restaurant versus for an executive team or a corporate team?
Principles are exactly the same. Whether I'm dealing with a family, a business, a church, any group of people with two or more gathered together for a purpose, David, the principles, I believe, are absolutely universal. And what I tell people is that, if our job as leaders is to identify and meet needs, let's make a list of what people need, right? And if you ever get stuck with that list, just ask yourself a simple question. What do I need? Well, respect. That'd be a great place to start. Treat me like an important person. So we got to be very careful about disrespecting people. I don't care where we are, if we're in a corporate suite or in a fast food restaurant, respect has to be a rule of the house, that we treat people like they're important. Herb Kelleher, the great servant leader from Southwest Airlines, used to tell his executives on a regular basis, Herb Kelleher was the founder, he used to say, if I ever catch you guys treating an employee differently than you would treat me, that's going to be a bad day in your career. He'd say, respect is not an option at Southwest Airlines, it's a condition of employment. That's what we do here. Respect is a rule of the house. So what do people need? They need respect. What else do they need? Well, how about appreciation? Mother Teresa used to say, the deepest human need of a human being is to be appreciated. She said, people need to be appreciated more than they need bread. And that woman saw some hungry people. It's a deep human need. So servant leaders you know, they appreciate people. You know, that's what they do. What else do people need? Well, they need to know the rules of the house. There needs to be accountability. There needs to be communication. There needs to be assertiveness. There needs to be listening. I mean, people have a lot of needs to create a healthy environment so they can thrive. And we know if you create a healthy environment for human beings, you tend to get good behavior. And that's what servant leaders mean. They're always, you mentioned the garden. I mean, that's an analogy I use a lot in teaching servant leadership. Is, you know, you've got to look at your people like a garden. What does my garden need? Does it need to be watered? Does it need to be fertilized? Do you need to remove the pests? Do you need to weed the garden? You know, what does my garden need? And that's what servant leadership is identifying and meeting the legitimate needs of your people so they can succeed and be the best they're capable of being.
Is there some choreographing involved with servant leadership to put elements of the business together that are going to kind of be good companion plans to each other?
And actually, I just finished my third book where I talk about this. How do we create a culture of excellence where people are people of character? They're doing the right thing. They're a culture of excellence where they're doing the best they're capable of doing. Where there's a culture of respect, where we treat people the way we want to be treated, where that's a rule of the house. How do you create a culture like that? And the answer is the organizations that I've worked with 37 years on the road now, the ones that do it best, they legislate it. They teach, they train their people, they set the standard. I call it the three F's, foundation, set the standard. What is it we're trying to achieve? What are the rules of the house? Anytime a new employee comes into an environment, David, they basically have two subconscious questions. How am I supposed to behave? What happens if I don't? How do you do your organization? How do you do this department? How do you lead? And people are constantly checking the boundaries of that. So the first thing the leader does is they set the standard. You got to set the rules of the house. What kind of a culture are we trying to create? Is excellence a rule of the house? Is character a rule of the house? Is respect a rule of the house? So you got to set the standard. Then the second step is, the second F is feedback. Now you got to coach people. So if I'm above the bar, if I'm a person of great character, a person of great excellence, a person of great respect, I better be getting some feedback on that. I better be getting rewarded. I better be getting appreciated. I better be getting talked about. I mean, we got to reinforce that great behavior. Now, if I'm performing below the bar, if there are gaps between the rules of the house and how I'm behaving, there better be immediate feedback and friction. That's the third F, creating friction. So that, you know, David, if there's gaps between our standard and your performance, we're going to be talking about that stuff. And not once a year in some silly performance review. We're going to be talking about it today, never more than tomorrow. We're going to be talking about that attitude. We're going to be talking about how you're disrespecting people or not bringing excellence to the team or not doing the right thing. We're going to be talking about that. You know, if there's no consequence for bad behavior, David, why would you think it would change, right? So that's part of what the servant leader does is not only do they do the hugging, but they got to do the spanking. And that's you know, obviously not capital or corporal punishment we're talking about. It's a metaphor for there's a tough side to servant leadership and there's a soft side to leadership. And most of us fall off the horse one way or the other, Dave. That's my experience, is that most people are either on the relationship side or they're on the task side. You know, there's those people who are just all task-oriented. I don't have to have a relationship with you. Just do your job. You know, when I want your opinion, I'll give it to you. They're just task-oriented. They're not, and the relationship doesn't matter. And the problem with that is it's not sustainable. Because over time, if you break the relationship, now it's just compliance. It's just, you know, you got me from the neck down. You got my hands and my legs and my back. But you don't have my heart. You don't have my mind. You don't have my spirit. You don't have my creativity. You don't have my excellence. I mean, every year Gallup does these employee engagement surveys for 30 years all around the world. And in the U.S., we've got 30% employee engagement, 30% of people who are committed and making a positive contribution to their organization. That's what we call getting them from the neck up. They're all in. We got 50% who are not engaged, who are just totally compliant. Just, you've got my hands, my legs, and back until 5 o'clock. I will be compliant. I will do the bare minimum. And then you got another 20% who are actively disengaged, who not only are they not bringing value to your organization, they're trying to sabotage you. And these stats haven't changed in 30 years. Gallup's been doing these polls. So, I mean, 30% engagement in the U.S. I mean, it's a national disgrace. And it's not a millennial problem. It's a leadership problem. You know, so the bad news is 30%. The good news, we're the highest in the world, David. Europe, their engagement levels are about 20%. East Asia, single digits. single digit of employee engagement. So, you know, how are you going to create a culture where you have people engaged? Well, the three F's, you got to set a foundation. You've got to set the rules of the house, and you got to make it clear to everybody that there are standards. There are ways that we run our game here. And then you've got to give people feedback against how they're doing against that standard. And then you've got to create friction to enhance those positive gaps and eliminate those negative gaps. So you got to get the whistle around your neck, and you got to be a coach, and you got to create it. There's no magic dust, David. You don't create a great culture just watching PowerPoint presentations or reading books. It takes a lot of hard effort, and very few organizations excel at it. There's very few that ever truly achieve excellence.
And you said so much in that answer, so I want to dig into some of what you just said. We need to take our first break, so we'll be right back after this.
There's nothing wrong with reaching out when you need. I'll be there for you, and maybe you can be for me. With a kind voice, a few kind words, open ear for when you need to be heard. A warm heart, we can make that choice to be a kind voice, a few kind.
Hi, I'm Kathy King, founder and executive director of Canines with a Cause, and I use my kind voice to create awareness of the importance of companion animals in our world and their ability to heal a broken soul. Canines with a Cause rescues dogs from local animal shelters. The dogs are placed with incarcerated women where they live and train as comfort companions or service animals for veterans battling PTSD. We also provide free training classes for the veterans, which enables them to develop skills to train their own dogs and become experienced handlers. The dogs provide the veterans with many benefits, simple companionship, motivation to get out of bed in the morning, and unconditional non-judgmental love. Learning to train the dog also helps the veterans out of their homes and get involved again in civilian life. It helps them develop emotional coping skills and resiliency. The dog and handler create a strong bond through working together, and the dog is trained for specific tasks to help the veteran lead a more productive, less stressful life. Canines with a Cause strives to make the world we all share a kinder, more connected place. We do this by healing through unconditional love. Separately, it's difficult for a dog in a shelter, an incarcerated woman, or a veteran suffering with post-traumatic stress disorder to share their kind voices. But by creating a channel process to bring them together, they can be a kind voice to and for each other. If you would like to know more about Canines with a Cause, visit our website, canineswithacause.org. Thank you.
Kind Voice Radio.
Welcome back to Kind Voice Radio. I'm David Levins. I'm here with Jim Hunter, J.D. Hunter Associates, talking about servant leadership. And there's a link to J.D. Hunter Associates' website right in the show description. Jim, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, David.
Now, you talked about making it sustainable on an organizational level. What are some of the, if you walked into the organization, how can you tell if they have a sustainable servant leadership model working?
Well, you know, I guess a layman would walk in. I don't know how I would answer that question. I mean, I guess it would depend by what kind of service you're getting. I mean, I can walk into an organization, David, now. I've been doing this for so long. I've been in hundreds of organizations, literally. I can sense in 5 minutes whether or not it's a culture of excellence or not. It's by the culture is the repeated behaviors, the repeated habits, the way we do things here. And it's the way people are being treated. It's the way it's there's a spirit. There's a community spirit to a culture of excellence for me, it's palpable. And I think most people can relate to that. It's that restaurant that you keep going back to, that place you have breakfast regularly, or that place maybe where you take your dry cleaning. When you walk in, or you go to a Ritz-Carlton hotel, or you fly on Southwest Airlines, I mean, just something different about the way they do business. It's the way you're treated. It's the way your problems are handled. It's palpable in the first 5 minutes. Cultures of excellence. I'll give you an example of this. My wife and I went through some cancer for several years, and we got treated here in Detroit, and we were just getting the usual runarounds and waiting, you know, 10 days to get test results and all this stuff. And somebody said, "Well, you know, you really ought to you really got to call the Cancer Treatment Center. And I said, well, I've heard about it. I've seen their commercials, but, you know, they're not here in Detroit. I said, well, I'll just give them a call. So I called them up, and we ended up flying to Chicago. They sent us tickets to fly to Chicago. Didn't know who I was, didn't ask for a medical card, didn't ask for a credit card, nothing. All they said was, you need to come. And we spent 4 days there, and then ended up spending several years there. But David, the culture was this. The culture at the Cancer Treatment Centers of America in Zion, Illinois, is this. The answer is yes. Now, what is your question? That's just the way they do business, and it's about everything. You got a problem with your hotel? Well, we know Bill and Sally up the road. We got that. What else do you have? I mean, it didn't matter what it was. Your job is to get better. We've got everything else. And that's the way they do business in everything, from the valet out parking your car in front of the hospital to just, you know, there's a problem with the bill, we just take it off the bill. I mean, it's the answer is yes. Now, what is your question? So it's just the way that organization, it's like Southwest Airlines. I mean, David, I'm a several million mile flyer. That's all I do is fly airplanes, right? That is a commodity industry. I mean, you know, paying the same amount of money for those jets, the same amount of money for fuel. I mean, it's a commodity industry, let's face it. Yet, since 9/11, that industry has taken a $100 billion hit. All the majors have been in Chapter 11, Chapter 7, failed, merged, everybody but Southwest Airlines. Southwest Airlines has been profitable for 44 straight years, including the 15 since 9/11, which have been a disaster. So how do you explain that? I mean, it is they have all the same restraints and parameters every other airline has, but yet they excel. What's the difference? Well, the difference, David, is when you walk on a Southwest Airlines plane, there's a flight attendant standing at the door, and they say something like this to you. They say, welcome to my airplane. Welcome to first class. Welcome to my living room. You know, they don't even have first class at Southwest Airlines, but that's how that you're going to have a different experience today. And that's the way, how do you get people to own it? This is my airplane. You belong to me for the next 90 minutes. That is a culture of excellence. Now, that didn't happen by accident. When Herb Kelleher started Southwest Airlines back in the early 70s, he went to New York and he said, I'm going to start an airline. And they laughed at him. They said, Herb, you got to be nuts. Everybody knows you can't make money flying airplanes in America. And he said, well, I'm going to have a little different business model. And they said, well, what's your business model? He said, well, you know who's going to be number one? And they said, well, of course, the customer. And he said, oh, no, customer is not number one in Southwest. No, the employees will be number one at Southwest Airlines. And the analysts in New York were horrified. Kelleher, you need to be drug tested, man. Everybody knows the customer's number one. You're nuts. And Kelleher said, well, just call me a dumb Texan. But the way I got this thing figured is that if I'm serving my people, and they're number one, and I'm meeting their needs, and I'm creating excellence, that's going to make my customers happy. And if my customers are happy, I think that's going to make my shareholders happy. And if my shareholders are happy, I think it's going to work out pretty well. But just call me a dumb Texan. Well, that was 47 years ago, and the data is now in, David. The data's in. Nobody can touch him. Now, if you were to ask Kelleher, how did he do that? He would tell you, we love our people. LUV, the airline that love built. I mean, Southwest Airlines, their ticker symbol on the New York Stock Exchange is love. Southwest Airlines fires customers regularly, fires them. Southwest Airlines has a no-fly list. I mean, we all know TSA has a no-fly list. Southwest Airlines fires customers regularly. In fact, you can Google it. The first customer that Herb Kelleher fired, he said, we love you and we'll miss you. Nobody treats our flight attendants that way. So that employees are number one and we're serving our employees, that wasn't just some throwaway punchline. He was serious about that, and he built an airline on that premise that has survived three CEOs since him, that they have kept that sustainable. And that is their culture. That is the DNA. They serve one another. They have a servant spirit. That's one of their values. And they have fun, and they are warriors. They turn an airplane in 20 minutes. The next best airline can't do it in double that time. So they created this culture and they made it sustainable. How'd they do that? By serving their people and making their people number one.
And I've had that experience on Southwest Airlines. The people are just incredibly nice. So what you're saying works, and it leads to profits. How do you suppose it influences that employee, how they conduct their personal business, being treated that way at work?
Yeah, well, that's the thing. You know, when you create culture, we create a culture of character. And by character, I'm talking about, you know, a culture is the collective character of the organization. Personal character, you know, the cliche is character is that person you are in the dark when nobody's looking, right? The real you. It's the sum total of your vices, your virtues, the real you, the person you are in the dark. Winning those battles between what you want to do and what you should do, right? Those wars between you know is the right thing to do and taking a little shortcut. And we each have our personal character, and we're developing it every day. I mean, leadership is your character. It's who you are. You know, it's that person that can inspire people, you know, your personal character. It's not about your personality. You know, my wife could do a 30-minute test and tell you what your personality is. Are you a dominant, an influencer, a steadfast guy, type A, type B? You can go to a seminar. You can't go to a seminar and move from a type A to a type B personality. Your personality was pretty well fixed by age 6. Your IQ was fixed by age 15, but not your character. Hence the term maturity, moral maturity. So culture is our collective character, our repeatable habits that the organization now has become. It's an organism. It's the way we do business here. And when people enter that culture, you either rise with that level or you don't make it. You know, the tide of the harbor is very high in a culture of excellence. And if you don't rise to that, the antibodies within the organization will root you out. I mean, that's why they have so few supervisors at Southwest. They don't need them. I mean, the people, this is just the way we do things. We turn a plane in 20 minutes. We treat people with respect. I mean, that's what we do. And that is that's a very tough thing to do. Now, the point I'm trying to make from all this is that when you create character at work for people, that's a roadshow. You take that home with you, right? I mean, it's really the biggest gift organization can give their employees is help them to develop their character on the job because they're going to take that with them. They're going to go home and be better mothers and better fathers and better husbands and better wives because your character is a roadshow, right? I mean, you don't fake your character. I mean, your character is what it is. And so for me, I mean, leadership is all about your character. I mean, what is leadership? Leadership is doing the right thing even when you don't feel like it. It's the right thing to do to have patience and self-control and to be kind, to be humble, to be respectful, to be selfless, to be forgiving, to be honest, to be committed. That's just doing the right thing. So what is character? Character is just doing the right thing. And what is leadership? Doing the right thing. Leadership is just character in action. Character in action. And so when we help people to develop leadership skills in the workplace, all we're really doing is helping them grow their character. Character, doing the right thing. I have never in 37 years of teaching servant leadership anywhere on the planet, David, had somebody raise their hand and say, I disagree with the principles of servant leadership. I would rather have a boss who's impatient, unkind, arrogant, disrespectful and selfish, unforgiving, dishonest, corrupt, and uncommitted. I mean, the principles of servant leadership, David, are self-evident. I mean, nobody's going to say they disagree with that stuff. The difficult part, David, is not getting people to agree to this stuff. The difficult part is getting them to change. We are bundles of habits. I mean, if you haven't been appreciating people for the last 20 years of your career, you think it's going to change because you read another book or watch another PowerPoint slide? Or if you haven't been holding people accountable to excellence, and you haven't been telling people the truth about their performance, you've been dishonest in your leadership, you think it's going to change because you read another chapter out of my book? No, no, no. The way you develop leadership is you've got to get in the water. You've got to practice these things. You know, leadership, you don't develop leadership intellectually. And this is the big mistake most organizations make, David, is they think if they send people to class and have them read books, they're going to become better leaders. Uh-uh. That's not how you become a better. You don't develop humility. The number one quality of a great leader is humility. Good to great, all the data, everything shows the greatest quality of a servant leader is humility. Well, do you think you develop humility reading books? No, you develop humility by practicing humility. So being a great leader, David, is precisely analogous to being an athlete. It's precisely analogous.
You got to practice the principles.
Yes, nobody ever learned how to swim reading a book. You can learn about swimming, but you're never going to become a swimmer until you get in the water. You can know all about something and never know it. I meet people like this every week of my life. They know all about leadership, but I'm not sure they ever served a person a day in their life. You can know all about something and never know it.
It's leadership powerful.
Pardon?
It's very powerful stuff what you're talking about, because not only is it the right thing to do, but it makes businesses more profitable. Do you think
absolutely.
By making
absolutely.
Businesses more profitable, it's going to help the trend of more businesses having servant leadership?
Oh, well, the data is in. Every year, Fortune magazine publishes the 100 best companies to work for. And that's not just based on people feeling good about being there. It's also based on metrics like profitability and sustainability. And where these companies, where they ranked in the S&P and the Dow? And the correlation between cultures of excellence and performance at the bottom line, I mean, it's not even arguable anymore. I mean, that's been cleared up for 15 years now. There's no question what a culture of excellence will produce. I mean, 30 years ago when I started talking about servant leadership, David, people wanted the data. You know, show me the data. Show me this stuff works. I want to see the data. Well, we didn't have a lot of data 30 years ago. Well, we got a ton of it now, David. The data is all in. I mean, it's absolutely inarguable. The number one best-selling business book ever, hardcover, is Jim Collins' book, Good to Great. It's a book about servant leadership. In fact, on page 30 of the book, he says, we debated calling these leaders servant leaders, but in the end, we decided to call them level 5 leaders. We thought if we call them servants, people will get the wrong idea, which I think is true. I mean, people do struggle with what does that mean to be a servant leader, and people get hung up on that. But his book is the empirical evidence for servant leadership, and I encourage people to read it. You want data. He did a 5-year study, the best leaders, the best organizations on the planet, and what those leaders were doing. And there was a direct one-on-one correlation between character and performance. Direct. So, I mean, the data is inarguable. It's in, you know, again, David, the difficult part is not getting people to agree to this stuff. I never have anybody raise their hand and say, I disagree. The difficult thing is, okay, how are you going to get it into your game? How are we going to move this stuff from our head to our heart? And how are we going to get this from our heart into our habits? And that is the challenge, because people are bundles of habits. We got to help them change. And that's the challenge. Getting them to agree is not the challenge, David.
This is powerful stuff, and I want to explore it a little bit deep. And your grasp of it is amazing, so I want to discuss that as well. So we're going to take a quick break for a good news report, and we'll be right back after this.
Hi, everyone. This is Brianna Dinscher with your Good News Report, where we deliver happy and exciting news from all over the world. This week, we have a very uplifting story from Lake Charles, Louisiana, where a firefighter rescued 6 baby ducks. The most interesting part is that he brought them to safety with the help of his iPhone. After he was notified that several ducklings had been caught in a drain, firefighter Cody Necht headed out to the location and created quite of a clever plan. He wriggled into the drain and got this bright idea to impersonate the duckling's mother using the quack, quack, quack ringtone on his iPhone. His idea did in fact work, and after about an hour and a half, 4 of the 6 ducklings were rescued. The remaining 2 came out later, and all 6 were finally reunited with their mother. This is definitely a very cute and unique story, because it is not every day that you hear of someone spending so much time with such a brilliant trick to rescue little ducklings. In my opinion, Cody is definitely using his kind heart to bring more love to his neighborhood and is helping the small creatures in his community. This week's quote of the week comes from the great Dr. Seuss. Today you are you. That is truer than true. There is no one alive who is youer than you. Thank you for listening to today's report, and I hope that you continue to use your kind voice to bring happiness to others. Take care, guys.
A Kind Voice Radio.
Hello and welcome back to Kind Voice Radio. I'm David Levins. We're here talking with Jim Hunt about servant leadership. Jim, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, David.
Jim, I'm totally amazed at your grasp of the subject, how you could know something's on page 30 of a book. Now, you have all the things you know about servant leadership probably organized some way, but then you're constantly learning new things. Can you talk about the process of how you organize your whole knowledge base of servant leadership, and then when you find something new, how you incorporate that into this knowledge base?
Yes. Well, you know, a couple of ways, I think. I mean, I learn so much from my clients. I'm so blessed by what I do. I mean, I get to work with some of the best organizations on the planet. Tomorrow I'm flying to Fort Campbell, Kentucky. I'll be working with the Army. Spend about 20% of my time working with the military, working with Fortune 500 companies, Malcolm Baldrige winners. I mean, I work with great organizations, great people who get it. I mean, let's face it, if they're calling me about servant leadership, they tend to be people who are character people and get it. So I work with great human beings. So I learn a lot from them and things that they're practicing and things that they're doing. I've always said I've learned more from my clients than I think I've ever given to them. So that's one of the ways I'm out there learning every day. I read a lot, David. You know, I'm one of Amazon's good customers. Let me put it that way. And you know, I read a book or two a week for sure. And so I'm constantly reading and looking for new ways of doing things and that sort of thing. So those two ways, and I get to practice this stuff with my clients. I mean, about a third of what I do, two thirds of what I do is what I call preaching a sermon, David. I go in and unpack servant leadership for people, like we're doing tonight. I go in and teach people the principles of servant leadership. Everything from a 20-minute keynote to half a day, we go and I unpack it for them. But the other third of what I do is I help organizations who want to help their people get this stuff into their game. So I'm actually involved intimately with corporations for a six-month period where I'm working with their leadership team to help people, help their leadership to develop their character, quite literally, you know, to move it from their head to from the knowledge into the heart and into the action, you know, getting them in the pool and getting them swimming around and being awkward for a second or two and practicing these things. So I get to learn and experience. And I'll tell you, the biggest thing lately that I've been so humbled by, David, is by just how much people can change. You know, I think there's a little piece of me, you know, my grandpa was a farmer. He used to say, you know, people don't change that much, son. It's like putting perfume on a pig. They just don't change that much. And, you know, that just isn't true. I mean, my grandpa was smart about a lot of things, but he missed that one. I mean, you don't think people can change? Go to the local library and pick up the books of people who not only change their lives, they change the world. But there's a part of me that still says, well, this guy's kind of a command and control Nazi, and he doesn't get it, and he yells at his people. And there's plenty of those out there still alive and well everywhere in corporate America. But what amazes me, David, is how much I see people can change. I have seen Nazis become servant leaders. I mean, leaders who people literally would turn their chairs in the conference room and face the other way, that kind of detest their leader that much, where they don't even face the front of the room. I have seen people like that change and become servant leaders. It's not common. I mean, that sort of thing has been rare. But the point I'm trying to make is I'm amazed and humbled by how much people can change when they put their mind to it, when they decide, when they make a choice to improve their character and make different choices of how they're going to behave, how they can transform their lives. It's a very humbling thing. And one of the things people struggle with, David, in becoming better leaders is they lack belief that they can change. Well, you know, I've never been a listener. That's just not who I am. Or, well, you know, I don't like conflict. That's why I don't tell people the truth about their performance. That's why I lie to people on their performance reviews, because I just don't like conflict. Well, listen, you know, if you don't appreciate people or you don't listen or you don't hold people accountable, it doesn't mean you're a bad person. It means you've got a bad habit. You can change that. You develop these habits over time, and you can change these habits over time. Our character is our choices. We're making hundreds of character choices every day. So you got to get in the water, and you got to start making some different choices. And it's going to be awkward for a season. That's okay. Be awkward for a while. Guess what happens? It starts to become unconscious and skilled. And that's when you don't have to try to be a good leader. You are a good leader. Your thoughts became your actions. Your actions became your habits. Your habits became your character. Your character became your destiny. So key to all this, and I keep coming back to this point, is that you got to get people in the water. You know, one of the first things I ask my audience, David, is I'll say, how many of you believe in continuous improvement? And how many hands do you think go up, David?
Probably all of them.
Of course, every time, no matter what I am. Oh, everybody believes that. I said, okay, so here's the next question. Can you improve if you don't change? Well, of course not. You know, what Einstein said, you know, definition of insanity. Continuing to do what we've always done, hoping for different results. So, okay, we can't improve unless we change. So you want to be a better leader. What does that mean? It means you've got to change. Well, how are you going to do that? What's your plan to change? Today you don't appreciate people. Today you're not listening well. Today you're not holding people accountable to that. Whatever it is that your stuff is, and we all have stuff, the gap between where we need to be and where we are, we all have stuff. Whatever your stuff is, what is your plan to change? And when you get people on that road and practicing getting after their stuff, getting them in the pool, it's a phenomenal thing to see how much people can change. And it's so humbling. And so the point I'm making is that one of the big barriers people have, David, to becoming better leaders and better people is they lack belief. So we do it in community. We do it with teams. So it's kind of like the same thing you do with AA or Weight Watchers groups or Dale Carnegie groups. You get people in a group together where they start to talk about their stuff. They start to make a commitment to everybody what they're going to do. They start to see other people change. They start to see growth. They start to get belief. And it starts to build on itself. They start to build community together. And so that's how we do it in an organization. I don't do it one-on-one and with my executive coaching or anything like that. We do it in groups. We get the executive team together, and everybody gets feedback on their leadership. And everybody's got to pick two areas they're going to work on, and they've got to make it specific. They've got to make it measurable. They got to stand up and talk about it. We call that opening the kimono. They got to talk about what they're going to work on. They got to report back every 30 days how they're doing. What are their people saying? I mean, you create an environment where you got to grow, you got to change, you got to get after your stuff. But when you get people laser focused like that and really starting to work on their behaviors and their habits, it's transformative. It's absolutely, absolutely transformative. There's a new book out. Well, not new anymore. It's been a couple of years. The Power of Habit. I mean, you've probably seen it, David. It's the Charles Duhigg, the New York Times bestselling author. It's a powerful book. But what he talks about in this book, The Power of Habits, is that all the new science, all the neuroscience, everything is pointing to the fact that people change best in a group. It doesn't work well on your own because you'll lack motivation. You need encouragement. You need support. You need feedback. We need accountability. You need push. Need belief, and that's what community gives you. So, you know, in an executive coaching situation, I mean, I can fool my executive coach. I can fool my boss, but I can't fool my people. I can't fool the people I'm working with every day. I can't fool my family. I can't fool the people who are reporting to me. You know, you don't fool them. So when we include those people in the process of growth, it becomes very, very, very powerful. And that's the key to all this stuff, Dave. We can talk about leadership until the cows come home. And we write interminable books about it and all these classes and all this stuff. But in the end, David, leadership is not an intellectual thing. You don't become a better leader in your neocortex agreeing with a set of principles. The only way you're going to get better is you got to get in the water and you got to change up what you're doing. The part corporate America, the most part, misses. We think if we read books and watch PowerPoint slides, we're going to get better. That's not how people change. That's not how they grow. You can agree with this stuff all day long. You can know all about leadership and never know leadership. That's the key, getting them in the water.
Wow, it's very powerful stuff. And if you could wave a magic wand without worrying about reality or anything like that, what would you do to get the people in the water, the leaders in the water, to see these principles at work and to live them?
Well, it takes leadership. It takes a person at the top of the organization, or the family, or the group, to say, folks, we're going to get better. Continuous improvement is no longer a punchline that we're going to be throwing around. We're actually going to start getting better, which means we all have to change. And it's not going to be easy. There's going to be some heavy lifting. We're going to have to get feedback. We're going to have to take a hard look at our stuff, the gap between where we are and where we need to be, and we've all got stuff. It's okay to have stuff. The key is, are you getting better? Are you going to be better 3 months from today than you are today? Are you going to be better a year from now? You know, you keep moving the ball up the field, David, you end up in a completely different place. So what are we going to do for this 30 days, this 90-day period? What are we going to do to change and grow? And so you got to have a leader. You got to have a leader that takes responsibility for that and says to the team, guys, this is where we're going. So we're going to go through a process where we're going to get feedback. We're going to be accountable to one another. We're going to stand up and open our kimonos and talk about our stuff, and we're going to grow. And they are intentional and they are laser focused. They don't just hope it's going to happen. You don't create an excellent culture by chance. Let me give you an example. I was at a Ritz-Carlton hotel. Have you ever been to a Ritz-Carlton, David?
Yes.
Okay, so you know what that's about, right? You walk in the door and the excellence is palpable, right? And it's not just the way they're treating you. It's the way they treat each other. It's just this culture of excellence, this aura of extraordinary respect that just surrounds the people that work there. And they're known for that. So years ago, I was at a Ritz-Carlton with my wife, and I was put up there with my client in San Francisco. And we're going downstairs to go out for on the town, and my wife said, let's stop and have a drink. So we went up to the bar at the Ritz, and this bartender brings over a big bowl of mixed nuts. And so then he leaves, just sets it in front of us, and he leaves. And I'm looking around to see if anybody's watching, and I just start eating the cashews out of it because I love cashews, right? and we left. So about midnight, we come back, and we're walking through the lobby, and my wife says, let's just have a quick drink before we go back up, and sat down at the bar. And what do you think the bartender brought over to me, David?
Cashews.
That's right. He brought me a bowl of cashews. We know you like cashews, Mr. Hunter. I mean, I felt like I was in the Twilight Zone. I mean, I'm like sitting there with my wife is saying, close your mouth, honey. I mean, I was like, and how did you know my name? I mean, I was like, this is nuts. I couldn't believe it, right? Not only that he saw me do that, but that he knew my name. So I'm sitting there kind of confounded, and I'm watching this guy behind the bar, just the excellence, the way he's treating the busboys and the maids and the servers and the guests. And, I mean, he's just all over, just excellence dripping on this guy. So finally, I just said, get over here, young man, get over here. Sir, I said, I want to know right now. I want to know right now, how do they get you to do this? I have clients that would, for 10% of the customer service I've seen out of you in the last five, I want to know right now, just between us, how do they get you to do this? He said, Mr. Hunter, relax, I'll tell you. He said, come on, I want it now. He said, Mr. Hunter, we have a motto here at the Ritz-Carlton. I said, oh boy, here we go. What's your motto? He said, we are ladies and gentlemen serving ladies and gentlemen. I said, okay, that's real snappy. What's your point? He said, Mr. Hunter, if we don't behave this way, we don't get to work here. Anything about that you don't understand? He said, our general manager has a huddle up with us every week, and she reminds us, this is the Ritz, guys. You want to do mediocrity? The Holiday Inn is right up the road. The Red Roof Inn is right around the corner. This here, this is the Ritz. We do excellence here. Does anybody want to play? And they legislate it, David. They legislate character. This is the way you're going to behave if you're going to be doing the Ritz. I mean, it doesn't happen by accident. These organizations that deliver these kinds of culture, Southwest Airlines, the Ritz-Carlton, the cancer treatment centers, and there are others, and you've been to the others, you know what it is. You walk in the door, and it's palpable. That isn't an accident, David. That is intentional, laser-focused commitment to culture, servant leadership, and excellence.
Now, it's very impressive how they embody the static, because static doesn't mean much unless you bring it to life. And it's impressive what they do at Ritz. So we're going to take our final break.
The alchemy of kindness is one that we believe. When we reach out to each other, you know we both receive.
Hi, I'm Bruce Grammel, one of the original hosts on A Kind Voice Radio. My song, The Alchemy of Kindness, is about the good things that happen when kind voices come together. What you're about to hear is a message from Claire Bloom, who is using her kind voice to feed hungry children. We hope that you'll help Claire with her mission and make our world a kinder, more connected place, one act at a time.
Hi, I'm Claire Bloom. In 2011, I started End 68 Hours of Hunger, in an effort to overcome childhood hunger right here in America. There are more than 16 million children in America who are hungry. Between the free lunch they get in school on Friday and the free breakfast they get in school on Monday. And what we know is that if we feed these children on the weekend, they can achieve 50% higher reading scores, 30% higher math scores, and are twice as likely to successfully complete the third grade, which is a primary indicator of high school graduation. To find out more, I'd love for you in contact with me. We have a website at www.n68hoursofhunger.org, or you can email me directly at n68hoursofhunger@gmail.com. I'd love to hear from you. Thanks.
Hi, I'm Dominic Damaski, and I'd like to thank you for listening to A Kind Voice Radio. This is a place where we have conversations with an eclectic group of people who are using their kind voices to help make our world a kinder, more connected place. If you'd like to add your kind voice to the conversation, we are currently looking for new program hosts, producers, and bloggers. For more information, please check out the Using Your Kind Voice tab on our website, akindvoice.org. If you or someone you know happen to be creating a good story, We'd love to have you on our program. Please go to the radio menu at akindvoice.org and click on the show that best connects with your store. Then scroll down and click the guest information link. Thanks again for listening. And remember, please use your kind voice to make a difference and make somebody happy today.
A Kind Voice Radio.
And welcome back to A Kind Voice Radio. We're here with Jim Hunter talking about servant leadership. Jim, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, David. I'm enjoying it.
So am I. Now, there's so much going on, and I could see where it's a lot of visiting the clients and bringing the concepts to life. Do you use technology at all, the internet and Facebook, to help the mission of bringing servant leadership to life?
Well, I've got some people behind the scenes that are helping me a lot in those areas, especially with the release of my next book here. We're going to start getting a little more savvy in those areas. But, you know, I've been very, very blessed, David. I 37 years of being in business. I have never done any marketing. I have never done one flyer, one phone call, one bit of with the new internet stuff, Facebooking, Twitter, anything. I have never had to do any marketing whatsoever, and I've just been as busy as I can be. Because the principles, you know, the principles of servant leadership work. And once you get an organization that's committed and willing to do the effort, take the efforts and the commitment to dive in the water and really start helping people change and grow, this stuff works. When you go into an organization, change. You see change. I mean, CEOs talk to other CEOs at spreads. And, I mean, servant leadership is just on fire right now. Not only here in this country, it's happening all over the world. I mean, people are so sick and tired of bad leadership. Even in places like Libya, Syria, and all over the world, they're so tired of command and control leaders that are just not responsive to the needs of the people. And, you know, the time has come, and there's nothing more powerful than an idea whose time has arrived. I mean, servant leadership's been around thousands of years. And, you know, I think that's a point I do want to make, too, because if I fail to get this in, I think a lot of people won't understand servant leadership. Years ago, when I first heard the concept of servant leadership, I thought it was pretty ridiculous, to be honest with you. You know, I mean, serve? You know, I'm the boss now. You're supposed to serve me. I've been in the bowels of the ship kissing all these supervisors' rear ends for the last 20 years. I finally get to be a supervisor, and you're telling me I have to serve again? I don't think so. Now you're supposed to serve me. I'm the head of the house. I'm the mom. I'm the dad. I'm the coach. I'm the boss. I'm going to call the shots now. You're going to be responsive to me. Servantly, are you kidding me? I mean, that might be okay in the hereafter or at a church somewhere, but it's not relevant in the real world. It's ridiculous. And the reason I didn't understand it was because I didn't understand the difference between power and authority. And if you don't understand the difference between having power over people and having authority with people, you'll never understand what, you'll never really grasp servant leadership. I didn't until I understood the differences. One of the founders of sociology, a guy named Max Weber, he's German, 100 years ago, articulated power and authority. We still use these definitions today in the universities. And power is simply do it or else, right? Do it or I'll bomb you, spank you, beat you up, write you up, fire you. I can make you do my will, even if you would choose not to, because of my position or my might. That's power. And organizations are filled with it. The world is full of power people. I'm the boss, you're not. When I want your opinion, I'll give it to you. So we all know what power is. Now, what is authority? Authority, think of the root of the word, author. Author is something that you did, something that you have authored, something that you've created or given existence to. If you're my boss at work, you would have no power over me if the company didn't give it to you. The power doesn't reside within you. It resides in the organism. Authority is what resides within you, right? The skill of getting people to willingly do your will because of your personal influence. That supervisor on that side of the room, I'd walk through a wall for that person. The one on the other side of the room, I wouldn't walk across the street for that one. It's your personal authority, people, right? So the question, leadership is not about your power. I mean, you're a vice president, you're the boss, you're the coach. People aren't impressed by your power, especially millennials. Millennials are not impressed with your corner office. What matters is do you have personal authority with people? This is something that you have authored, something that you have given existence. This is about relationship, right? Do I trust you? Are you committed? Do you care about me? Or do you just care that I can help you hit your numbers? Do you care about me as a person? Do you know about my sick kid? Are you in the game? Or who is this about? Who's serving who here? So you look at the great leaders in history who had no power but had tremendous authority. People like Jesus, people like Gandhi, people like Mother Teresa, people like Martin Luther King, Nelson Mandela, people who didn't have any power, positional power, but had tremendous authority, right? When they spoke, they had the attention of the world. Where did they get that authority from? Well, they served and they sacrificed. It cost something. I mean, when they served and they sacrificed, people listen. And that's the universal language. When you serve and you sacrifice for someone, you get their attention. In Detroit, in labor circles, we have an old saying, my pay is my right. My pay is my right. I earned that. Your praise, that's your gift. You're starting to get my attention now. So servership is about building a personal moral authority with people. You build it through relationship. You do it through day by day, getting in the game with people, growing them, helping them, giving them the tools they need to be successful, the hugging, the spanking, the metaphor I used before, helping them. The test of leadership, the whole test of leadership is, do people leave you better than they found you? Do people raise their game as a result of being around you? Right? I mean, that's the test. When your children leave your home,
very powerful.
Are they going to be ready?
And as you're talking about how this is applied in business, I'm wondering, do you ever go to like high schools or junior high schools and try to teach teachers on how to use the principles of servant leadership?
I do, and I'm doing it more than ever. In fact, week after next, I'll be out in Seattle talking to 2,500 kids, and I'm spending a lot more time there, and I love it. And teachers, oh, David, whenever I get a group of leaders together, one of the very first questions I always ask, and I've done it for 30 years, is how many leaders do we have in the room? I always ask that question. And, you know, in a group of business guys, you may get half. In teachers, a group of teachers, I've never had more than 10%. Raise their hand. And I'm thinking, my 12-year-old daughter spends half her waking hours in your classroom, and you don't see yourself as a leader? David, in the macro, everybody's a leader. Leadership is influence. Leadership is the mark you're leaving on people every day. In the macro, everybody's a leader. Yeah, because everybody leaves a mark. The question is not, are you a leader? The question is, are you effective? Are we going to be glad you were there? Is your organization going to be better because you were there? Is your neighborhood going to be better because you lived there? Is your church going to be better because you worship there? It's your mark. We all leave a mark. You don't have to be the boss to leave a mark. We all leave a mark. The only question is, do you make things better? So in the macro, everyone is a leader because everyone is influencing people, for good or for bad, every day, choice by choice, day by day. But in the micro, people have been entrusted to our care. As husbands, as wives, as fathers, as sons, I mean, we have people entrusted to our care. And so now our leadership is just somewhat where now our job is to identify and meet legitimate needs of these people who've been entrusted to our care. That is a sacred trust. That is serious meddling in people's lives. And that's really the first principle of servant leadership. I mean, it's an awesome responsibility to be a leader. And that's one of the things I focus on with leaders, is getting them to understand. I mean, my gosh, if you're a boss at work, people spend half their waking hours in the bowels of your ship. They spend more waking hours at work than they do with their families. What more awesome responsibility is that? And what kind of mark you're leaving on them when they go home to their families? Or as a parent, if I'm your kid, David, I'm stuck with you for the rest of my life, right? You're my parent. You will always be my dad. I can't get away from that. Think of the awesome responsibility of being a parent. Or being married, somebody signs on their life to you. See, that's where servant leadership begins. I mean, it's being humbled by the awesome responsibility of having human beings entrusted to your care. And our job is to serve them, to identify and meet their legitimate needs, not to be slaves to them, to help them to grow, to be the best they're capable of. And, man, that takes a lot of effort. That takes a lot of love.
It does, and a lot of it's about love and feeling that sense of responsibility to take care of each other. You shared so much wisdom in the last hour. It's just amazing your grasp of this subject. Is there anything you haven't asked that you'd like to share before we close out?
Well, boy, you're a good interviewer because you got me to say the big things I want to say. And, you know, we We talked about what it is. We talked about it doesn't come intellectually. We talked about you got to get in the pool. And all those things are very important. But at the end of the day, David, what we said right at the end is probably the most important word, and that is love. And I talk about love a lot in business seminars. And that was a choice I had to make. I mean, 25 years ago when I made that choice to talk about love in my books and my business seminars, that was a risk. Because, you know, human resource people in organization, corporate America, they don't like that word, you know. We're trying to get sexual harassment out of the building, Mr. Hunter. what are you talking about love for? I mean, you're killing me. But, of course, I'm not talking about love as a feeling. We're talking about the classical definition of love, where love is a verb. Love is always a verb first. That's like we've lost this. Hollywood's butchered the word love and reduced it to a feeling. Love is much more than a feeling. Love is a verb first. An act of love is an extension of myself, an extension of myself for others. Vince Lombardi, the great coach, had the greatest love quote I've ever heard. He used to tell his players every spring training, he used to say, ladies, you don't have to like me. I don't have to like you. But as your leader, I will love you. And he said, my love will be relentless. I'm going to love you to death. Now, what did he mean by that? That's the classical definition of love. When you leave my team, you're going to be in demand in the NFL. I'm going to make you great. That's the test of love. Do people leave you better than they found you? And there may be times feelings are incidental. You know, there's times my wife doesn't like me very much. It doesn't mean that she doesn't love me. That she isn't still patient and kind and forgiving and honest and committed and still in the game, even though I'm acting like a jerk this week, right? That's what love is. Love is all in. And so I spend a lot of time in my seminars talking about leadership. It is really character and love in action. Because what is love? I mean, just think of the great definition of love, David, that everyone, pretty much everybody knows. It's read at millions of weddings around the world, the age-old definition of love written by a Jew named Paul 2,000 years ago. It's one of the most famous passages in all of literature, the definition of love. Read at millions of weddings. What is love? Well, love is patient. Love is kind. Love is humility. Love is respect. Love is selflessness. Love is forgiveness. Love is honesty. Love is commitment. There are no feelings on the list. None. No feelings at all. They are all character behaviors. So again, David, I started this whole thing out by saying, I have never had somebody raise their hand and say, well, no, I'd rather have a boss who is impatient, unkind, arrogant, disrespectful and selfish, unforgiving and dishonest, and uncommitted. I'd like to have a parent like that. I'd like to be married to someone like that. I'd like my coach to be like that. The principles are self-evident. Again, David, the difficult part is not getting people to agree to this stuff. It's getting them to change, getting them in the water and practicing these things.
Wow. And there's just so much going on, but you just summed it up very well on the macro level. I appreciate you taking this time to join us and all the great work you do.
Well, it was my pleasure. I love talking about this stuff. It's been my life's work. And, you know, I often tell my audiences, David, you know, all this stuff I write about, all this stuff I talk about, I stole it all. I'm a thief. I admit it. This stuff has been around for thousands of years, David. There's nothing new about it. It's just truth that resonates universally. And again, the difficult part of life isn't knowing the right thing to do, David. The difficult part is doing the right thing. And that's what separates, you know, leaders from the great leaders, doing it.
Wow. And that sums it up perfectly. Jim, thank you so much for coming on.
You betcha. Blessings to you. Bye-bye, David.
Blessings. Bye. And that was Jim Hunter. And, I mean, the Beatles said it, love is all you need. But Jim is a practitioner of love. He does this with servant leadership, putting it into play in organizations, which has such a domino effect in so many areas. So it's been a privilege having Jim on the show. I want to thank Yolanda Riley for producing the show. This is David Levins asking you to go out and use your kind voice to make a difference in somebody's life.
Here in our garden, we gather to share all that's inside of us, how much we care. Find strength in our difference and reach common ground. Celebrate our unity in a tapestry of loving sound. So make a kind choice with your kind voice, and united we will find our kind voices. sing song. Some find forgiveness for a choice that was wrong. Some of us be children, some help people in need. All of us in our own way are planting a loving seed. Make a kind choice with our kind voice, and united we find our kind voices inside. Which sing out in unity, creating community and bringing us together as one. And each moment brings on changes, and each change helps us see that we're all of us a part of our. Kindness deep within us makes us time.